continuing with the tractate of Sanhedrin, and I want to just review one point, the halachic point that we made last week, because I feel that it's, you know, it's something new, perhaps, you know, in terms of the halachic abstraction. And we have in Torah. Torah is not just a system of philosophy and psychology and civil law and religious law. It's also a system, an educational system. And as we learn Torah, we come across certain educational principles. And one of them is review. And now review in learning Torah doesn't mean simply repeating over what we learned in order that we should remember it. That's not review. That's review in a college-style review. You review things over so you remember them for a test. But in the Torah system of education, review is really part of the learning process. In other words, reviewing is refining, going over again, and after you see the idea, you review it through many different ways of expressing it so that you refine it as much as possible. That's why it says one of the 48 ways that Torah is acquired is through lengthy speech. That means that that when a person studies, it's important that he shouldn't just think in his mind, but he should express it verbally. Verbalization is really a further development of thinking. And part of that process is that first when you learn something, so then you grasp the ideas, but then you have to review. When you review, that's when you really crystallize the concepts and the ideas. And that's why the concept of review is so important. The Talmud says if a person studies and doesn't review, it's like a person that plants and doesn't harvest, because the reviewing is the harvest process. That's the final formulation. So with that little introduction, let me just review the concept that we did last week. The question we had was that there are seven laws of Noah, and then one of the scholars of the Talmud adds the blood from the living animal. And we said that the debate here is not a question of seven or eight. Everybody agrees seven. We've shown that from a further piece of Talmud, that the number seven was carried down from Sinai. So that's not debatable. So therefore, when the blood from the living was added, it wasn't added as a new law, but that particular scholar thought that the law of consuming a limb that was taken from an animal during its lifetime also includes the blood. It's one law. And we explained that there are two ways to construe, two ways to understand what exactly the law is, that a person is not permitted to consume the limb of an animal that's taken during its lifetime. One way is straight and plain. The law is simply you cannot take the limb from the animal during its lifetime, and then one is not allowed to consume that. If that's the case, then blood would not be included. We've shown that. Okay, because we've shown that a human being is you're not permitted to eat a human being, yet the blood of a human being is permissible, according to the Torah law. The rabbis made a violation on that too, for obvious reasons. But the Torah laws, it's permissible. So you see that blood and the flesh are two different things. So if you say, if you understand the law of Eiver Min HaChai, that's what it is in Hebrew, it means the limb of a living animal, to be a violation of taking the limb, simply taking the limb, so then you'd only be referring to the flesh of the limb, not to the blood. But there's another way to construe it. Another way to understand this is that the organism of the animal during its lifetime is totally prohibited. And in order to become permissible, what you require is the event of death. And the moment the event of death takes place, then it's a permit on the everything that's included in the animal. So if that is the case, so that would include the entire organism, would include the blood as well. Now, the here is something where we're studying halacha, so we have to become familiar with the framework of halacha. And here we have a concept of an halachic event. So just like in physics, you have an event in physics. You could have if an electron changes its orbit, that's a subatomic event. Now we have to, when we study Torah, we have to realize that there is a new realm of events, and that is called halachic events. Now, according to this way of interpreting, what we need in order to consume the animal is the halachic event of death. So death now, when an animal dies, it becomes an halachic event. Okay? So so this event is what gives the individual a permit, so to speak, to consume that organism. If blood was taken from the animal, or anything was taken from the animal itself, aside from the milk, but if anything was taken from the animal itself during its lifetime, then there's no permit because it's alive. So there are two ways to understand the violation of a limb of a living animal. One way is to the removal of the limb is the violation, and consuming the limb that was removed. Or the other way is that the entire animal is in a state of prohibition during its lifetime. What you need is the halachic event of death. And death is a permit on everything that is in the animal, everything that's a part of the animal, which would include the blood as well. Okay, but the important thing to get used to is this concept of an halachic event, and the concept that an halachic event can act as a permit and can give a person a right, certain rights, which he didn't have previously. This would be the way of understanding the law of removal of a limb of an animal during its lifetime. It's not the removal of the limb that's the prohibition. The prohibition is partaking of any animal before the halachic event takes place that gives you the permit, which is namely the death of the animal. Okay? So in that, if that's the way we construe it, so then it would include, you'd say the death is a permit on the organism. It would include the blood, any part of the animal whatsoever. So we see here that there are two ways to describe, to define, to define the halacha. And this is the way, I mean, from this case, you begin to see how to interpret a piece of Talmud. Every time you have an argument, you must go to the source, find out what was carried down from Sinai that is not debatable, and then see why each one takes a different position. And the reason that they take a different position is because they interpret it differently. They understand the concept of the law to be different than the other individual. And based upon the way they understand the concept, different consequences emerge. Okay, this is a good example of how halacha works, and you'll see this continuously. As we go along, I would like to also be able to have you develop to the point where you can distinguish between a halachic question and a philosophical question. Because halacha and philosophy are two different things in the system of Torah. They're both important, they're both there, but they are different and they're treated differently. I'll take a question now that occurred to me. The question is that we see that the Torah always goes against and tries to uproot the attachment that man has to pagan and idolatrous practices. Like, even though according to the Talmud, by the way, with regard to this argument, we maintain that a ben och is not prohibited to drink the blood. But the ben Israel is not permitted to have blood, to drink blood. And that's because, Maimonides explains very well, because people always thought that blood has certain powers, and drinking the blood gives a person certain mystical powers. And, of course, the Torah is against that kind of idea, that kind of mystical idea. So the Torah made it a primary violation to drink the blood. Drinking blood is like an idolatrous kind of thing. If you take they consume the blood of the animal, then you think you're gaining the power of the power and the strength of the animal. As a matter of fact, one of the primitive practices was to take an animal, and different clans had different animals that were gods to them. And what they would do is they would sacrifice that animal like once a year or so, and then they'd have a big meal called a totem meal, and they would consume the flesh and the blood of the animal, you see. Now, consuming the flesh and the blood gave these people the feeling that they are now partaking of their god, because they're consuming the god's flesh and blood, and now they're gaining the strength of the god. This is a very strong primitive, religious urge, and I think you recognize it very quickly in the Christian, Christian Eucharist, the blood and the flesh of they consume the blood and the flesh of their God. Again, it's the exact same practice. But the Torah, of course, prohibits these things because they're primitive and they are they take a person away from the real God and they put them in the realm of idolatry. So it's a prohibition. But what's interesting is that really, according to Maimonides, where the flesh of a human being is a prohibition, it's not as strict a prohibition as eating an animal which is prohibited, like a pig or a horse or a camel or one of the animals that are non-kosher. So it's interesting. And I say it's not as severe because violation against eating pig is a negative violation, which is stronger. It says you should not eat this animal. Violation against eating a horse or a camel or any non-kosher, a lion or a bear, any non-kosher animal, is a negative violation, which is always stronger. The violation against eating a human being is only, according to Maimonides, is only a positive violation. Of course, the Torah says you should only eat these things. It excludes anything else. So that would exclude man. Now, you understand, and it's logical, that a negative violation is always stronger than a positive. Of course, a positive is an indirect kind of thing. Like the Torah says, this is what you should eat, to the exclusion of man. But there's no specific mention in the Torah, nowhere in Leviticus does it state you should not eat man. Okay? Now, according to Nachmanides disagrees. Nachmanides maintains that there isn't even any violation of the Torah at all for eating a human being. The question that arose in my mind is the Torah always goes against the primitive practices and tries to uproot them. I mean, that's the whole purpose of the Torah, to uproot the primitive practices. Yet, one of the most primitive practices, if a person studies at all the cultures of the primitive people, one of the most primitive practices was cannibalism. Cannibalism is a very, very strong instinct in primitive society. And it's interesting, but the Torah, it seems strange, why didn't the Torah ban and outlaw cannibalism as it did the drinking of blood and partaking of an animal during its, while it's alive, these primitive practices. Why didn't the Torah also outlaw cannibalism, which is consuming human flesh? Okay, I was thinking about it, and I believe the answer is that the cannibalistic state, if you study the level of people that are in a cannibalistic society, that state is so low and so far removed from the world of knowledge that they aren't even capable of receiving any laws or commandments. So I believe the reason is that the Torah was given to people that have to at least be on the level. You see, the violation has to at least be on the level where the person is in the realm in the realm of receiving a commandment. But the cannibalistic society is so primitive that there's no, you don't have to outlaw it, because if you're referring to those type of instincts, then you can't be giving the law to those type of people. And if you're not, if the people are above the cannibalistic stage, then there's no reason to prohibit it. But you see, the Torah really never prohibited, never had any specific prohibition against cannibalism. And I believe the reason is because it's assumed that that the people that are receiving the law are out of that, beyond that stage. If they're in that stage, then it's, of course there's no, it's hopeless. The people are, can't even receive any law in that stage. Okay, now now this is what I want to mention to you. What you should have noticed is that I switched out of halacha to philosophy. This type of a question, why did the Torah not prohibit the consumption of human flesh, is not a halacha question. It's a philosophical question. And it's important to note that, because as we study halacha, we have to, I want you to get a feel for halacha and to see and to recognize what is halacha and what isn't. They're two different subjects. So we've digressed into a philosophical point. But it's okay to digress, but what you have to know is, when we digress, you have to recognize that it's a digression. Because if this is a class that is going to, that we hope to advance in Talmud in, then we have to always keep our categories straight in our minds as we study. So it's okay to digress, but we got to realize which realm we're in, what framework are we in, when. Okay, so now let's get back to the Talmud itself. The point that we made last week was with regard to that piece of the tractate of Sanhedrin, and we're going to continue and take the other positions as well. Okay. So that's 56b. Now, we mentioned the position, and now we're going to skip over the next one, the one of Reb Chitka. We'll come back to that one. He says even the castration of animals. Okay. Now, even castration is a prohibition. Now we're going, certainly of humans as well. Now, according to Rabbi Simon, we're skipping over Rabbi Hitka. We'll come back to him. We're going to go to Rabbi Simon. Rabbi Simon says even it is a violation for a ben Noah even to be involved in magic. All right? And then Rabbi Josi says, he adds, and he says, whatever is mentioned, not just simple magic, but whatever is mentioned in the section of the Torah, in the paragraph in the Torah that deals with magic, a ben Noah is prohibited to violate. And here is the section of the Torah, and what we're going to do is we're going to go back to the source, as we should, and take a look at the Bible itself, because we're going to be explaining some verses in the Bible. Now, the verses that he's referring to are Deuteronomy 18. Okay? Now, if you take a look, we're going to have to take the trouble of looking into the Bible itself and seeing what the statements are. So, 18:9. It says, I'll just give a loose translation. It says that because you are coming to the land that that God your God is giving you, you shall not learn to do like the abominations of these nations. All right? By the way, it's important to mention that when it says you shall not learn to do, so the Talmud immediately, the oral law states, that it means you're not permitted to study these things when you're studying them, you're studying them because you want to learn to do them. But you are permitted to study them in order to understand what these things are and know what they are and understand them. That is permissible. But if a person is curious about them and he just studies them because he's drawn to them emotionally, That is a violation of the Torah. Of course, it doesn't say you shouldn't do. It says you shall not study to do. You shall not learn to do. So even the learning process is a violation. But the Talmud explains, the oral law explains very beautifully, that these two words go together. You shall not learn to do. It's a kind of learning which may result in doing. Even if there's a chance it'll result in doing, it's prohibited. It means learning out of curiosity, because you feel emotionally drawn to those practices. That's a prohibition itself. But if you're studying the practice in order to understand it, in order to be able to comprehend how people, the psychology of it, the nature of it, or anything about it that has to do with knowledge, that is not prohibited. As a matter of fact, the Sanhedrin had to study these things, and because they had to pass judgment on it, so it wasn't just a matter of an optional study, they had to know it. And any area of knowledge, the Torah always tells a person to study and to gain knowledge, all kinds of knowledge. There's no knowledge that's prohibited in the Torah, but studying because one is emotionally drawn to it, that's a dangerous thing, and that's prohibited. Okay, now verse 10. Verse 10 says, there shall not be found among you anyone who makes to pass his son or his daughter in fire, and that was a form of idolatry, as you probably know. And then you have the next few words. Actually, it's four different statements. Four different categories here. You have the first one, in Hebrew, is kosem kesamim. I don't know what your translation says, but these are different types of magic. And I'll explain what they are to you. Okay? There are four of them. Okay. The first one of them is called kosem kesamim. Now, what that means is as follows. That means a person, there are different forms, and we could recognize some of them even today, but not all of them, because times have changed. But this one is where a person, in order to be able to forecast the future, what the person does is he tries to meditate, so to speak, to get his mind blank, so that this even today we're familiar with. To get his mind to a blank state so that some kind of future events will come into his mind. And then he believes that those things that came into his mind under that trance are true. Okay? So that's a kind of a trance meditational phenomena where the person believes that when he puts himself in this trance and he gets certain feelings and certain thoughts, that these thoughts are will come to pass in the future. That's the first one. Okay. The second one is, again, commonly recognized today. It's astrology. That a person says, this day is a good day, that day is a bad day. All right. Today is bad. If you study the stars, you'll see that it's not your lucky day. So the best thing for you to do is stay in bed today. That's the second one that's a Torah violation. That's called Ma'onein. Okay, now we have another one. The next one is Menachesh in Hebrew. What that means is that a person says he makes signs for himself. Like he says, I spilled my coffee, or this something dropped, or a black cat crossed the street, or any kind of thing like that. And then he says, because that happened, I'm not going to go. I was going to do this business deal. I was going to see this person, but nope, that's bad luck, and I'm not going. That's the third category, again, a major Torah violation. The last one in this verse is called Mechashev. Now, Mechashev is, what that means is the person does magic, okay? Magic, sleight of hand. And the question, of course, arises, is sleight of hand a prohibition today? And the answer is, that there are certain times. Now, here's where, and this happens to be an interesting thing because it's unusual. So usually, halacha has a very rigid form, and if you violate the form, then that's the violation. God does not want you to do that action. Over here, the form is tied to the situation, and it's rare, but there are cases like that. In other words, doing magic in a way where you you present to people the idea that there's some force, a power here, that is a prohibition. But if it's done as a trick, and people know it's a trick, then it's not a violation. Okay, so that's the opinion of many scholars, including my teacher, Rabbi Feinstein. I one time discussed this with him. That in this case, you have a few cases like that where the violation, and it makes a lot of sense, that the violation is not the trick. I mean, a card trick or doing something, taking a bunny out of a hat, the rabbit out of a hat, is not a violation as long as you aren't implying that you have some supernatural force. If everyone knows it's a trick, then it's not a violation. That's strange because usually in Allah is more rigid than that. But there are certain cases like that. I'll give you another example. Another example is, you know that there's a violation in the Torah for a man to wear women's clothing and vice versa. Now, many times on Purim, which is a holiday in which, you know, there's a very jovial holiday, so people have plays and they have men come out as women, you know, and different things like that. So in the Shulchan Aruch, it's stated that that is permissible. Of course, the violation of the Torah for a man to dress as a woman and vice versa, one of the reasons, or the framework of it is to actually disguise one's sex for sexual purposes. But if it's done if everyone knows it's just a joke, so then the halachic violation is not in existence. So these are rare cases, I want you to know. They're rare, and you have to know exactly when and where it is that way. But there are cases in the Torah where the framework and the setting plays a role. The setting and the framework of the event plays a role. And this is one of the cases. The one that we're studying now, the case of doing magic, like a sleight of hand and various magic tricks that people do today. If it is done in a way that one implies that he has some power, supernatural power, and by the way, that is very common as well. I mean, there are many instances of charlatans today, and they still around, still exist, that do certain things that they claim that they have certain powers. And as a matter of fact, there's one magician who's called the Amazing Randy, and he always, what he does is to disclose what these individuals are doing. And his lifetime work is to challenge anyone that maintains they have any kind of power and to show exactly what they're doing to the public. And he's done that on a number of occasions, which, in the eyes of the Torah, is a mitzvah, by the way. That is the proper thing to do, to show that this is nonsense and people are being fooled by these things. He's had a few shows on television, by the way, which I've seen and which are quite interesting. And of course, this is the proper thing. This is proper. Those people who are implying that they have powers are an example of what the Torah would consider a major violation, to perform something which appears to be magical, and to imply that they're able to do this because of certain powers. Okay, now we're up to verse 11. And in verse 11, the first one we have, I don't know what your translation is, so I'm just going to say, I'll just read it in Hebrew. Okay. Chover, chover is what it is in Hebrew. It's a hard one with that ch. But what it means is, the basic meaning of it is, as Maimonides explains, it means that the person says certain magical words, incantations, and he believes that these incantations are going to be effective, to have some efficacy in bringing about some positive or type of result. Okay, it's usually words that are like that.
Rabbi?
Yes.
We must change the tape. Okay, we were discussing before we get to this point. You're discussing about women wearing men's clothes and men wearing women's clothes, etc., that today there's a lot of, they call unisex clothes. How does this fit into the concept of halakha?
Okay. The violation of the Torah of having one sex wear the other sex's clothing is only if the clothing is exclusive for that sex. And it depends on the situation and the society. In other words, at a time when women didn't wear pants, so if a woman wore pants, slacks, that would be a violation of the Torah. But however, once the style changes and women wear slacks, then it is not a violation, because it's based upon the prevalent dress of the society at the time. You understand very well, Bible, the Torah, could not give at that time, a specific, because its customs and styles change. So there the Torah used the society as the framework. So it depends on the society and the time. If a woman is wearing pants that are, even today, if she's wearing pants that are exclusively male, then it will be a prohibition. I'm not familiar enough to know whether there is such a thing. But the woman's slacks would not be a violation. So it must be, the violation is only if the person wears a garment that is exclusively the garment, the dress of the opposite sex. Okay. Getting back to the biblical verses here in Deuteronomy, and again, of course, you understand very well that without the oral law, no one knows what these things mean, and there's no way to even guess it. To guess it in any kind of intelligent way. We are fortunate because the exact interpretation of what each one of these things is carried down and was carried down through the oral law and is in the Mishnah. Okay, so the next thing that we're doing is, which one did I do last? Now the next one is, the one who asks an ov and yidoni. Now, basically, what that is that the person, this is really where a person, what the person does is that they get together like a seance, and they usually, I think even today they do this, they have like incense burning, okay? And then what they do is a person asks them, it's a seance, and the person asks the performer a certain question, and the answer comes from a very low voice that is a very slight and low voice. It's exactly, pretty much like a seance today. And then these answers come from an unknown source, an unknown voice, okay? And it could be sometimes the voice of a dead person or, something similar to that. That's the one who asks of the ov, and then the yidoni is similar. This we don't have anymore. I've never seen this. But in the second case, they do the same kind of a thing, but what they do is they put the bone of a certain bird in their mouth, and then they fall to the ground like they're struck, and then they speak from their mouth certain things that are going to happen in the future. So those are basically two forms. But I think the idea is pretty much clear. And the last one is the one who is Doresh Elamesim. It means the person who searches after the dead. And this is what they would do in that case would be they would hunger themselves, go on these fasts, and then they would go and sleep in the graveyard and wait for the dead person to come to them in a dream in order to answer certain questions. That's basically the way they used to do it. But of course, it means anyone who tries to bring back the dead or consult with the dead in order to find that information. All this is prohibited. So, but just about to cover the gamut of any kind of magical, superstition, magic, and looking for trying to gain knowledge from people that have departed, and basically astrology, and it covers the entire gamut. Basically, I mean, the Torah is, of course, as we are fortunate to understand, thorough. So the Torah covers basically the entire gamut. All the emotions that are that man has in this realm have been dealt with in these two verses. Okay, so that's what the Torah says. Now the Torah says, the Torah continues, and that's 18:12. So what the Bible says here is, because it is the abomination of God whoever does these things. Now here again, the word abomination, abomination should not strike you as emotionally disgusting. There's nothing emotionally disgusting if a person says, look, a black cat crossed my path, I'm not going to go to work today. But that's an abomination. It's an abomination because what the Torah is saying is that that person is saying there is another force in the universe besides God. That's an abomination. Abomination means, whenever the Torah says abomination, it means the person is going away from God, traveling in the wrong direction. Okay? It doesn't mean something which is emotionally disgusting. It has nothing to do with that. It's philosophically disgusting, okay? It's philosophically a horrible thing to see a person believe in some other force other than the creator of the universe and the God of justice who meets out justice to each individual in his life according to his or her merit. That is the whole basic idea of the Torah. And any time a person believes that a black cat or some other thing is going to result in either their benefit or their harm, so this means that they are completely removed from the whole philosophy of Torah, which is that God gives a human being a reward and takes care of them in accordance with their level and in accordance with their merit. Not in accordance with any kind of crazy events or stars or astrology or any other kind of nonsense. It is amazing, of course. One of the most amazing facts in the world is that the Torah, when it was written at this time, the time that it was written, according to any account, there was no one in the world that believed this. Every nation in the world was superstitious. And they would search for the dead, and they would do all these kind of things. I mean, astrology, where we still have today. I mean, people today still. President Reagan was made decisions based on this. So you see how strong the primitive urge is, and yet the Torah, thousands of years ago, prohibited and basically considered it an abomination to do any of these things. The Torah, thousands of years ago, is more advanced than people are today. Far, far more advanced. People today are not even on that level. So this is one of the most amazing facts in the world. As a matter of fact, Sigmund Freud was so disturbed by this, he could not comprehend it. And that's why he tried to answer it with his book of Moses and Monotheism, which he himself really wasn't happy with. And he wrote to one of his friends, he says, Moses doesn't let me sleep at night, because he could not believe, to say that the Torah is not true, that it's just a fabrication, how is it possible that people thousands of years ago should be so advanced, more advanced than people are today? And Sigmund Freud knew more than anyone else how deeply rooted these emotions are. That was his whole life study, was a study of the unconscious, and he showed that these emotions are deeply rooted in every person. Even a modern person has traces of these things, and they're very strong. But in the primitive, they're brought out more. And he could not, at the end of his life, when he saw that he had a really sound grasp of the human mind and how it works, he just took a look at the Torah, at the Bible, and says, how is it possible that people thousands of years ago, at that time, there wasn't No one knew this, and no one. Everybody thought that people believed in this because these emotions are so powerful. So this was something which plagued him. He was never able to really fully explain. Of course, we know the answer is because the Torah was given by God, and without that, we would never, the people of Israel would never be able to arrive at such a level on their own. This was because God gave the Torah at Sinai. Now, verse 12, it says, of course, it's an abomination before God, anyone that does these things. And then it says, and because of these abominations, God your God is removing them from their inheritance and giving that inheritance to you. He's removing them from before you because they are involved in these abominations and you are not. Okay? Now, what the Talmud is, you know, goes through this, brings this up for a reason. Okay? And here it is. This is the opinion of the Rabbi Simon and Rabbi Jesse. And the opinion is that a ben noach is prohibited. The question, of course, is if a ben noach should do any one of these things. A ben noach gets up in the morning and decides that it's my unlucky day. Or they read the astrology column in a newspaper and they guide their life by it. Are they in violation of the seven laws of Noah? That's the question. In other words, a practical question, because today millions of people are doing this. So this is the argument. Here you have an argument between two scholars of the Talmud. One position is no, they're not in violation. The other position is yes. Now, of course, the question is, let's try to understand the position that says that they are in violation. You have to have, in order to say that you're in violation in the Talmudic system, you have to have proof, evidence. Without evidence, you can't do anything. You can't just say, no Talmudic scholar ever said, well, I feel God doesn't want me to do this. That's total nonsense. We do not know. No human being can ever say he feels that God wants such and such. We could never know that. The ways of God are far above our ways. So that's just arrogance and nonsense. Whenever a person feels that they know what God wants them to do, that's basically a egomania in the eyes of the Torah. The only way we know what God wants us to do is through prophecy and through the Torah. And the Torah is complete, and anything that we feel that we're doing because somehow or other we sense this is a righteous thing, I mean, we feel comfortable about that, that again is a primitive idolatrous kind of a... kind of an emotion which the Torah is very much against. That's why the Torah says you shouldn't add anything to the Torah. So, the question is, the burden of proof on anyone that wants to say there's a violation for the Ben Noah, he has to prove it. Okay? Now, the proof that they bring, that this position brings, is based upon a principle which we have discussed a long time ago when we did the area of blasphemy. And that principle was, the principle was that the Torah never punishes unless it warns. That's the literal phrase. I'll explain to you again what it means. What it means is there cannot be a punishment in the Torah for something that's not a violation. Okay? Because the Torah is not a book of punishments. It's a book of perfection. So therefore, if there is a punishment, it must mean that the person did some kind of a violation. All right? There is no punishment. There's no violation. There's no punishment. There's no such thing as a bad thing. Like there are certain religions where if certain things happen to you, that's bad. So there's a bad person. We don't have such a thing. The only thing we have is if a person violates the law, that's bad. If he doesn't violate the law, then there's nothing bad. So here, this scholar of the Talmud says, take a look at this verse, namely Deuteronomy 18:12. Let's take a look at it, he says. And you look at this verse, and what does it say? It says, because of these abominations, God your God is driving these people out from before you. And he's giving you their land. All right? Now, we know God is a God of justice, the ultimate justice. As a matter of fact, if you remember, when God came to Abraham, he told him, he says, your children cannot inherit the land at this point because the sin of the Amorites is not complete. What does that mean? That means that God would never take away land from people who were entitled to it. But it just so happened that the Amorites, the people that were in the seven nations that were occupying the land of Israel, their sin reached, it seems they got deeper and deeper into idolatry, and they reached a point where they didn't deserve anymore to have rights to the land. And at that same time, the people of Israel did deserve to have a land. So therefore, it was just for God to cause the people of Israel to inherit the land. But God does not just simply throw people out, even though the people of Israel might merit the land of Israel, but there are other people there, and that wouldn't be just. If you read it, you remember, I'm sure, in your readings in Deuteronomy, where God says that that you'll never have the area that belongs to Esau, in the beginning of Deuteronomy. And he tells of various Moab, you're not permitted to do battle with Moab, because I'm not going to give you from the land, because they have rights of inheritance. It's not just the children of Israel that have rights of inheritance. There are other nations as well, as are clearly mentioned in the beginning of Deuteronomy. Because God's system is just, and the children of Israel have an inheritance, and other nations have an inheritance as well. And one cannot take from the other. So this is stated pretty clearly. If you read the beginning of Deuteronomy, you'll see that this is openly stated a few times. So God is just. Now here, it states that God is driving these people out. Why? Because they have lost, they have forfeited their rights. How did they forfeit their rights? Because their lives have reached a level where simply that type of life is, in God's eyes, not worthwhile as a human being. It's not a human life anymore. It's below, it's subhuman, and therefore they don't have any rights to land or anything. Okay? So, the scholar of the Talmud makes a very important point. He says, we know a principle of the oral law. And again, this is a principle. How do you know the principles that come from Sinai? A very simple method. Where there is no debate, so then the record was clear. Where they always debate, any time the Talmudic scholars will debate anything. There's no holds barred. But the only thing that prevents a debate is where the record was accurate, and in that case, they didn't debate, because everybody knew that fact. One of the principles that the Talmud has, the Talmud states, is that you cannot have a punishment unless there's a crime, unless there's a violation. So therefore, this scholar says, look over here. Here's a punishment. We see that God is chasing these people out of the land. Well, isn't that a punishment to take away people's land? I mean, what could be a greater punishment than that? So if God is punishing these people, and it says why, the reason is because these people, if you take a look, again, it repeats it again in verse 14, because these nations that you are inheriting, they turn to these Ma'onanim and the Kosmim, and the magicians. Well, it actually means the ones that the astrology and which one is the Kosem is the trance, right? The ones that go into the ones that predict the future by going into a trance. So you see, the Bible states very clearly that the reason why these people are being driven out is because of these things that they do, which are basically, it doesn't say idolatry in this verse. It says because they believe in superstition and powers, magical powers. So this Talmudic scholar says, let's use our logic. We know from Sinai, one of the principles of the oral law is that if there is a punishment, then there must be a previous violation, previous crime. So obviously all these things are crimes. Otherwise, how could God punish them? Okay? So, that being the case, he says, it must be that Abednego cannot do any one of these things. And if he does any one of these things, he's in violation of the seven laws. Now, the question is, how could you say there's seven laws if I've just read to you a whole slew of the Torah gives the entire gamut of every form of magic and superstition and seances and all kinds of future telling and all these type of things. Any type of, by the way, magical healing is also one of them. It was also there. That's also part of the comes as a subdivision. I just didn't go into it. But all those type of things, incantations, all these things are clearly mentioned in the Torah. So if all these things are mentioned, how could we say that a Ben Noah is permitted to do these things? Then why is God punishing these people? Okay? So it would seem pretty... So therefore, now the question, of course, is how could they be seven if you have so many? The answer to that which I think probably most of you already know the answer. The answer is that it would come under idolatry, because it's the same exact type of behavior. Idolatry is where it reaches its pinnacle, but these are also forms of idolatry. As a matter of fact, you see the Torah, the in Deuteronomy in verse 10, you see that it does classify idolatry together with these things in verse 10, because that was an idolatrous practice to pass the children through the fire. They would sometimes sacrifice the children to the fire. They pass them through a fire. This was done for specific idols. So there wouldn't be a problem with the seven laws, because the seven laws are not treated in the same manner as the 613 commandments. In the 613 commandments, every one of these things is a separate commandment. Okay. But in the seven laws are really headings. So therefore, you'd have one heading which would include idolatry and sorcery and magic and fortune telling and all this type of superstition. All these things would be included in that one heading, and that wouldn't be a problem. Okay, so we don't have any problem there. Now, I'm sure most of you by now are convinced that it is true that this particular position in the Talmud makes sense. I mean, it's hard to argue against it. Yet we don't really, in the final analysis, we don't go according to this person. Maimonides does not agree with this position. And according to Mr. Ben-Noach, did one of these things, he is not in violation. Okay. So of course the question is, what do we do with this evidence that we have? What is the other position? Again, when we study Talmud, you have to get both positions. Okay. The answer to that is, unless somebody wants to try, if anybody ever wants to say something, I'm always ready to step back and let you do it. This one's a little tough. Okay. The principle that we were using is that there is no such thing in the Torah as a punishment. Penalty does not exist unless there is violation. All right. Now, this concept is
Rabbi?
Yes.
After you have articulated your position that you want to question, right. Miss Gail Ledford has one.
Okay.
Rabbi, you said that there was no actual prohibition against man eating man.
Right. According to one position, yes.
What about the preservation of life? How does that come into it?
Oh, okay. Let me clarify that. Anybody want to answer that? Maybe I'll throw it back at you. Anybody there want to answer that? I think that somebody might be able to answer that question there.
I think the answer might be from the peanut gallery, that the eating the person is only after they're dead. It's
exactly.
Not the killing of them.
Oh, exactly. Exactly.
Okay.
That's the answer, 100%. Yeah, you can't kill anybody. That's correct.
You can't kill them to eat them, but you can eat them after they're dead.
After they're dead.
But then I think you might see you see how the brain works.
Right.
You've been talking now for 45 minutes, and we're back where we started from. Because
that's correct.
Now, we discussed, you and I did earlier, that there are certain morals and ethics, and you brought this out, the cannibals are on the very lowest level.
Right.
That ethically, you just do not go out morally and eat a dead body.
Right.
But in extreme cases... In extreme cases, such as the example you gave last week of the people being trapped in the mountains, the bodies are dead, and it's either you eat this flesh, human flesh, or you die yourself.
Okay, maybe I'll just clarify that.
Okay.
All right. The prohibition against consuming human flesh is, of course, only after the human being is dead, because to kill a human being is a major violation. Now, whether there is, for Ben Noah, by the way, there is no violation. And I discussed this with David. Let's say, of course, when I say there's no violation, and this is extremely important, You have to understand what this means by no violation. We have different levels of violation. And that's why it's so important to study Talmud, because you get used to that concept, which is something that most people can't get used to. They either say, you can or you can't. No, no, no. In the Torah, when you look at the Bible, you see sometimes there's a death penalty. Sometimes it's stoning. Sometimes it's a different kind of a penalty. Sometimes it's sometimes it's stripes. So there are different penalties. Sometimes there's no penalty. Sometimes you bring a sacrifice. It depends on what the violation is. So anyone that reads the Bible, especially Leviticus, but throughout the Bible, you'll see that what God expressed in the Bible is that there are different levels of violation. And that's important, because when a person does something wrong, it's not just right or wrong. It's how wrong, how bad. There's some things that are more serious, some things that are less serious. A person must always know what he's doing. Even if he does something wrong, he must know what level of wrong he's on. Okay? Now, that's extremely important. So when a Talmudic scholar looks at a phenomenon, what he tries to do is he tries to place it in the framework. Well, what is this? Is this major? Is it secondary? Is it minor? Not because he wants to do it, but because he wants to understand. And if you understand the Torah, you'll understand that when something's a major violation, you have to understand why that is so horrible and why God singled that thing out as being so terrible. If you study that, then you'll understand what perfection is. Of course, when we know what evil is, the opposite is perfection. So the study of evil helps us in the study of perfection. And it's extremely important to study all these various things. It's a funny thing. You know, I was at somebody's home, and there was a very religious man that came to me. So he says, it's terrible. He says, what you see on television today, you see that, you know, murders are committed, horrible things are committed. Just hearing about these things is bad for us. So there was a fellow there who I had studied with in the yeshiva many years ago. He was an intelligent guy, a rabbi. He says, I don't understand you. He says, look at the Bible. The Bible has the worst things that are done. The Bible records everything, the worst horrors. So the truth of the matter is that second fellow was right. The Torah records everything. Sexual violations of individuals. It records the violations of murder. All these things are in the Bible, because the Bible maintains that you have to have knowledge and study every area. And if something is more serious, you have to know why. Why did this take you away from God to a greater degree? Then you'll know how to get closer to God. The negative and the positive are inseparable. Okay? So you have to know both. Now, over here, when we say something is permissible, for instance, I said a Ben Noach is not in violation if he consumes a human being. What I mean at this point is, he is not in violation of the seven laws of Noah. Okay? Did he do something wrong? I'll tell you what, yes, but not the seven laws. What he did wrong is that in the Bible it says that a human being is supposed to be treated with dignity. This is, if you remember in Deuteronomy, it says that when...
Rabbi?
Yes?
I hate to do this to you, but we really only have 60 seconds and we're trimming it.
60 seconds?
Yes.
All right. So there is a certain dignity for a human being, and to consume, to use the human being as food is obviously a breach in dignity. But that is a philosophical, for Ben Noach, that is a philosophical violation, not an halachic violation. And we have to distinguish between the two, because there, as I said last time, there is a system of halacha, and then there's a system of perfection. If a Ben Noach would do that, certainly he would be at an extremely low level. But would you have to remove him, is he a violation of the technical seven laws? No, he is not. Where does he stand in relationship to God? He is distant from God. So we have to distinguish between the halacha and between perfection. And we come back to that same area. We have to categorize exactly what we're discussing. So we'll continue this next week. I think we're running out of time. Okay. Have a good night, everybody.